This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. The old saying goes that if you want to avoid a nasty argument at the holiday dinner table, steer clear of politics and religion. Now, a new study by the Pew Research Center implies that Vermonters may not have to worry much about avoiding at least one of those topics. Vermont has been identified, and not for the first time, as the state with the highest percentage of residents per capita who do not affiliate themselves with any major religion. But before you conjure up an image of Vermont as an atheist playground, it's a good idea to dig into the research itself to find out what, with apologies to Raymond Carver, what we talk about when we talk about religion. And we have three guests with us today well-versed in the topic of religion. First, the Associate Director of Research at Pew Research, Gregory Smith. And thanks for being with us today on Vermont Edition, Gregory.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Jeffrey Potash, a Vermont historian and co-author of the book Freedom and Unity, A History of Vermont. He's also president and co-archivist at the Ojave Zedek Synagogue in Burlington. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mitch.
And we also have with us Rebecca Neal Gould, a professor at Middlebury College and a scholar of comparative religion and of religion and American culture, also the author of At Home in Nature, Modern Homesteading and Spiritual Practice. Rebecca Neal Gould, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Mitch. It's great to be here.
And we want you to join the conversation as well. Do you consider yourself one of the unaffiliated identified in the Pew Research Survey? What does religion mean to you and your family? Do you consider yourself a spiritual person without necessarily being religious? Or do you adhere religiously, if you will, to a well-established religious faith? You can join the conversation by writing to our Vermont Edition Facebook page or by calling us at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And Greg Smith, let's start with you in this Pew Research survey. How was the question worded in this survey, and what did the numbers show?
Well, we asked a lot of pretty detailed questions about people's religious identity. We tried hard to drill down and identify specific denominations with which people identify with. But that said, the main question we asked and the first question we asked about people's religion is a pretty simple one. What is your present religion, if any? And then we gave people the option to choose among a variety of choices, including Protestantism, Catholicism, Mormonism, Orthodox Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, other faiths. But then people could also choose to identify themselves as atheists, or as agnostics, or as simply having no particular religion. And it's those latter three categories that we call the religiously unaffiliated, and that's the group in the United States that's really growing.
And that is reflected in these Vermont numbers with the highest percentage per capita of those calling themselves unaffiliated. Is that right?
That is right. In Vermont, we found that 37% of respondents said that they had no religion, and that's as high as we see in any other state. Now, there are states that come quite close to that. In New Hampshire, for example, 36% of respondents said that they have no religion. There are also lots of people in other states like Alaska and other places in the United States who have no religion, but Vermont is right up there at the very top.
And Greg, when was this survey conducted? Because it seems to me that Vermont has been down this road before, that we've heard these kind of numbers coming out of the Green Mountain State.
Well, this particular survey was conducted back in 2014, so just last year, so these findings are very recent. But these trends have been underway for some time, and they are seen all across the country in every region and in many states. So it doesn't surprise me that even though the number of the religiously unaffiliated in Vermont might be growing, it doesn't surprise me if they've long been among the more unaffiliated states in the nation.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of religions were identified. There were subcategories that people were asked about. Were there any other big trends that you noticed about this as far as, let's say, declining numbers of Catholics or Protestants or that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's very interesting. If the unaffiliated share of the population is growing all around the country, and it is, it's up 7 points or so in these data, then that means that some other group must be shrinking as a share of the population, and the data suggests that that's Christianity. The proportion of Americans who identify themselves as Christians has declined almost 8 points since we first conducted this study in 2007. And those losses are driven primarily by declines within mainline Protestantism and in Catholicism, both of which have lost ground not just in terms of their share of the population, but perhaps even in terms of the raw numbers of people identifying with those faiths.
Give us an idea, though, overall about the numbers of Christianity in this country, because there are certain news outlets, let's say, that would use those numbers in the Pew Research study and say, you know, Christianity is way on the decline. It's fading out. I would imagine that is not the case.
Well, you know, it's sort of a matter of perspective. The decline that we see in Christianity is quite noticeable and quite sharp, and it's certainly something worth focusing on. At the same time, you're absolutely right that it's important to keep in mind that the United States continues to be a country in which most people, 7 in 10 or more, identify with Christianity. And in fact, the United States is home to more Christians than any other country on the planet. So it's important to keep both things in mind. There's no evidence that Christianity is on the verge of extinction or anything dramatic like that in the United States. But nevertheless, these declines are pretty sharp and worth taking note of as well.
And Greg, were these numbers just hard numbers, or did the survey say anything about why this is happening?
Well, the survey asks a whole bunch of questions about people's religious beliefs and practices, and we're going to be publishing the results of it over the course of the coming year. But the survey does point to a couple of things that are behind these trends. Number one is generational replacement. A big part of what's happening is that you have an older generation of Americans among whom the vast majority of people identify with Christianity, and relatively few say they have no religion. But what's happening is that as that older generation passes away, it's being replaced by a new generation of young adults that is far less Christian and far more religiously unaffiliated than their parents' or grandparents' generation ever has been. So generational replacement is a big key to what's happening here.
It's fascinating stuff. Greg Smith is the Associate Director of Research at Pew Research. Thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Now let's turn to our other guests for a closer look at Vermont's history and present-day relationship to religion. And Jeffrey Potash, I want to start with you, because when we look back on Vermont's history, I want to know what role, if any, did religion play. Would Ethan Allen, for example, have identified himself as a religious man?
No, Ethan Allen captures a type and a time frame. Remember, in the period of the American Revolution, there was a great desire to separate from the what was called the New England Standing Order, the Protestant tradition of upholding congregational churches. Allen epitomized the spirit of inquiry, and the book that he wrote in the 1780s, Reason the Oracle, the Only Oracle of Man, was the first deistical piece ever written in America, which essentially argued, took a naturalistic position, that God, the clockmaker, if you will, had wound up the clock and allowed it to run on its own naturalist devices, that there was no need for religion. But at the same time, there was an Ethan Allen. Much of Vermont was populated, it was a post-revolutionary frontier, by Protestant evangelicals. And you know, one of the fascinating things to me from an historical perspective is that religious evangelicalism, just as mainline Protestantism, tends to ebb and flow in Vermont history. The period of the early 1800s, in the aftermath of the American Revolution, there's this massive religious revival known as the Second Great Awakening. Vermont is a center. Certainly a majority of Vermonters at that time are embracing, you know, the evangelical tenets of grace as the primary Christian attribute and the notion of a rebirth. At the same while, Vermont, being this open space, has this wonderful competition that's really quite new in America in the 1830s and 40s. And that is to say that all of a sudden you begin to see more liberal, what we're characterizing as mainstream religions today. Then they were quite radical. The Methodists, you know, who advocated largely for good works as opposed to grace. God forbid the Unitarians and the Universalists, whose church was the first in Burlington, represented yet another very liberal position. So, you know, I think, Mitch, at some level, the Catholics would come later. At some level, we've had large numbers of religious groups here. And I think what we're witnessing in that sort of historical continuum is a moment in which the evangelical forces in Vermont are significantly diminished relative to the rest of the country. And in effect, that seems to account with the fall as well in Catholic participation for Vermont's situation today.
Rebecca Neal Gould, you've done some lengthy interviews with a large cross-section of Vermonters about their religious identities. What, if anything, surprises you about the Pew Research findings that we just discussed with Gregory Smith?
Well, that's a great question. And first, I want to say I think the Pew study is just fantastic. It's, you know, when you're doing quantitative research, it's hard to be nuanced. And I think this is the most nuanced study that I've ever seen. I'm not myself. I'm more of a qualitative researcher myself, but there's a lot of complexity here that I really like. One of the things that I found surprising was the geographic consistency of, around the numbers around unaffiliated, because you would think that might be some places more than others, that it might be more, say, East Coast, West Coast, New England, California. And the unaffiliated numbers, to the extent that I saw the details, are really consistent across geographic areas, and that surprised me. The other thing that surprised me had to do with education. There's an assumption and some numbers to support it about college-educated people being more apt to be unaffiliated. They get exposed to world religions. They ask big existential questions of the kind my students are asking all the time. I have a friend who once liked to say, oh, I read my way out of Catholicism in college. So you have this kind of assumption that that's going to be the people who are more unaffiliated. And from the data that Pew's come up with, that's not the case. It looks like high school educated folks who haven't gone to college are just as likely to be unaffiliated. So that's really interesting to me.
We're talking about Vermont's low affiliation with established religion today. We have with us in our Colchester studios Jeffrey Potash, a Vermont historian and president and co-archivist at the Ojave Zedek Synagogue in Burlington. Also Rebecca Neal Gould, scholar of comparative religion at Middlebury College. You can join this discussion, too. Just call us at 1-800-639-2211. You could post to the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's take a call right now. Let's go to Noelle, who's on the line in Brookline. Hi, Noelle.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thanks. Go ahead, Noelle. We may have lost Noelle as soon as we got her, but we'll see if we can get her back in just a moment. In the meantime, we do have many comments that have been coming in, folks writing about religion. Christy posted this comment: I'd like religion in Vermont a lot better if they paid taxes. We often hear that from folks who are not affiliated with a major religion. And Ivo posts: I find Vermont very Christian, at least judging by the number of churches in Rutland and by the number of my acquaintances worshiping there. There's practically every denomination around here. And of course, you can post your comments to our Vermont Edition Facebook page as well. Jeffrey Potash, one of the things that often surprises people when I tell them about Vermont, is when I mention, is that Joseph Smith, the father of Mormonism, was born in Vermont. And I understand Brigham Young as well.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
Is that just an historical coincidence, or does Vermont have an inclination towards religious invention, if you will? I mean, that is a fairly new religion.
Well, it's a great question, Mitch. And the answer is that, again, thinking of us as fertile ground in the early part of the 19th century, we actually were a haven for religious invention. In the 1840s, for instance, there was a gentleman by the name of William Miller and the Millerite movement, which came out of the revivals when the revivals didn't bring about the hope for the desirable end in the 1830s, the vision, the post-millennial vision that the world was spinning rapidly to its impending end. Miller began to assemble a large group of people out of Pulteney, and began to actually read scripture and interpret it in a way that actually gave him a date. And the Millerite movement went national, picked the date. Unfortunately, it never materialized, and that's one illustration. The other illustration, that's a contemporary of the Mormons in the 1820s, was in Putney, a man by the name of John Humphrey Noyes. Now, Noyes was part of the utopian communitarian vision of the 1820s. Again, another rendition of a spirit of the democratic optimism of the era. Let's change things and make them right. And his vision, which seemed to take hold in great ways, was forming a community on what he ultimately defined was complex marriage. His argument was that marriage, the ownership of one individual by another effectively, was the core evil within the world. He divested himself and his membership of that evil, and as a consequence was highly successful. The town fathers were not very pleased, and ultimately he was pressed to head out to the New York frontier, where he created the more familiar Oneida community. So, yeah, we have lots and lots of, you know, continuing on to modernity of experimentation in Vermont.
So I want to say something about that because it's really interesting. It's also a great reminder of everything I learned in graduate school. I'm like, oh, good, I still remember about the Millerites. And that is what you see in Vermont is a lot of religious diversity all along, both in the 19th century and further out. And the quote that you gave of someone who wrote in and said, well, there's a lot of different denominations. Vermont looks very Christian to me. And I think those things are true along with what the Pew study is giving us about unaffiliated, and that is that Vermont has tremendous religious diversity, which is one of the things that makes it very interesting. Not only lots of different Protestant denominations, but then we have Hindu and Muslim communities, the resettlement project, and people who are settling now that weren't here 30 years ago. That changes the landscape of Vermont. So if we just describe Vermont as unaffiliated and thought that the canvas was blank, that would be very much an inaccurate portrait of Vermont.
Let's try our luck with the phones again. Sean is on the line in St. Albans. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
Welcome to Vermont Edition. What's your question?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Not so much of a question. I just wanted to comment on the churches in our landscape. I think you know, when you're driving around Vermont and you see a steeple coming through the trees, it's a beautiful thing. It's part of our landscape, and I like to imagine when churches were better attended. And I know we have a lot of issues in the community that existed in different ways back then, and certainly not all the problems were solved, but I'm interested in people in Vermont being open to talking about their beliefs. I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and my son is going on a mission after his graduation to Montana, and I just hope that he and our missionaries here in Vermont will get a good reception and that people will be willing to talk with them.
Well, we wish him the best. And, Sean, thank you so much for your phone call. I have to agree that one of the great beauties of Vermont is how those churches, those beautiful steeples, are worked into the landscape. It's become such a part of the bucolic, iconic image of Vermont. It's really hard to separate from that. We've got so much to get to. We're going to just take a break for a moment. We are talking about religion today and Vermont's large population of the unaffiliated. Our guests are Vermont historian Jeffrey Potash and Rebecca Neal Gould. And you can join the conversation as well by calling 1-800-639-2211. Write to us at Vermont Edition's Facebook page. We're back right after this quick break. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. And today we're talking about religion in Vermont, or the lack thereof, in the wake of a new Pew Research survey showing that Vermont has the highest percentage of people unaffiliated with a major religion of any state in the nation. In our Colchester studios today, we have Rebecca Neal Gould, scholar of comparative religion at Middlebury College, and Jeffrey Potash, a Vermont historian and co-author of Freedom and Unity, A History of Vermont. You can join the conversation, too. Call us at 1-800-639-2211 or post to Vermont Edition's Facebook page. Are you one of Vermont's unaffiliated? Do you consider yourself non-religious but spiritual? What role, if any, does religion play in your daily life? We have this comment from Jolene from Winooski, who writes, I would like to say that I have a huge body of friends. A great deal of them are religious. Do they go to church? Do I go to church? No. I go a couple times a year. I am religious, though. What I mean is that I believe in God. A huge portion of my friends are the same. No church, just believe. So, Rebecca Neal Gould, I want to ask you specifically about that because I wonder if Jolene represents a larger number of people that would have trouble responding to that Pew Research survey. I'm religious, but I don't necessarily worship at a church.
Yeah, I think that's the difficulty with doing a quantitative survey like that, and I'll be interested to see if Pew gets at that in more detail when they talked about the future studies coming up and other research that they're doing. But yes, I think that's very common, and in the research that I've done, that is a big theme. Or people will say, I'm spiritual but not religious, which is kind of a false dichotomy, but something that many people use. And so what they mean by that is they're not comfortable in any one particular religious institution, or they haven't found, if we'll stick with Christianity for a moment, a church that has kind of the right people with whom they feel comfortable, or maybe the minister isn't someone they connect with. And for all kinds of reasons, they're saying, well, I don't need this particular doctrine and I don't need this particular community But when all is said and done, yeah, I believe in something higher, and the language of God is the one that I'll go with. And also, I mean, again, this is hard to capture in the Pew study of what is the life cycle story of a person. So whoever they interviewed at one particular moment might say, I'm unaffiliated. But were they Christian when they were young and their parents brought them, say, to a Methodist church? And at some point later in the life cycle, will they go back there? There's a category known as reverts, a term I'd never seen before in the Pew study.
Yeah.
And so I think the life cycle issues are important because most of us know people who've made different kinds of religious choices along the way, depending on where they are and what's happened to them in their lives. But yes, I think what she's speaking to is very, very common. And then once you interview someone and say, well, what does that actually mean when you say you believe in God but you're not religious? All kinds of complex stories emerge, and that's something that I'm very interested in.
Jeffrey Potash, I wonder if there's anything in Vermont's recent past or even present day that lends itself, do you think, to perhaps rejecting traditional religious labels more than other states do?
I think that, again, from an historical perspective, by virtue of the fact that Vermont emerged at a particular moment in time, and to the degree that it embraces this sort of secular patron saint, Ethan Allen, I think there's a propensity, you know, for people to envisage that Vermont is a place of independence, a place where basically free thinkers and free spirit spiritualism is embraced. So to that degree, I think there is a connection.
Let's go to the phones again. Robert is on the line from Burlington. Hi, Robert.
Hi. So I'm calling. I moved to Vermont in 2000, and turns out I'm a Mennonite. I grew up in the Mennonite church. There's not a lot of us, and so I'm used to being in places where there's not a lot of people with in the same faith community as me. But what surprised me when I came to Vermont, or what I at least impressed me, is that there was a kind of a peacenik community here already existing in Vermont that I've never seen really anywhere else that I've lived. You know, I came to Burlington, and there's already a peace and justice store. And now it even has competition. It has 10,000 villages. And coincidentally, the 10,000 villages store originally came out of a program called Mennonite Central Committee Peace Section, and then has become privatized since, or something like that. And so even though, as far as I know, there's only three Mennonite churches in the state, there's two of them on Route 4, both sides of Woodstock, and there's one of them in Walcott. But what we have in Vermont is we have a Mennonite camp, our camp that's a Christian camp that's run by Mennonites, and it's Bethany Birch's in Plymouth. And it's a really wholesome, nice place, and I think that for Vermont, I think that it's appropriate for a place like Vermont. It's very wholesome and natural and a good fit.
Robert, let me ask you this. I'm sorry I don't know a lot about Mennonites, but is there a tradition of peace activism in the Mennonite community?
Yeah, it's the Mennonites and Quakers and Church of the Brethren are what's called the three historic peace churches. So we've been pacifists from the very beginning of our tradition, and that goes back to like 1525 or something like that. That is the fact.
Thank you very much for the call, Robert. I really appreciate it. I want to try to get Noelle back on the line, who called earlier from Brookline. Noelle, are you with us?
Hey.
Hi. Thanks for calling back.
Oh, good. Yeah, well, I just wanted to share some of my own experience where, you know, I don't feel like putting myself in a box really resonates with me and joining an organized religion. I really find beauty in all religions of the world, and in a very, very pure central sense, they're all really going for a very similar thing. So I find myself creating my own spiritual practices and living every moment as my prayer, creating the most beautiful existence as I possibly can, and thankfully finding myself in a community where a lot of people are doing the same, just really creating their own existence.
And Noelle, would you describe yourself as spiritual but not necessarily religious?
Sure. I mean, yeah, one could describe describe my situation as that.
Well, I do thank you for the call. Thanks for giving a call today. And, of course, we are talking about religion today. If you'd like to give us a ring, call 1-800-639-2211. Jeffrey Potash, I want to ask about people who move to Vermont from away. Do they tend, in general, to be more secular, folks that are coming in now?
Great question. Again, my sense is that people typically are drawn to communities, that when one thinks historically, and the reference to the Mennonites, you know, recalls Vermont's proud tradition of Quaker communities, again, in the Revolutionary era. Let's not forget, you know, for instance, that the Robinson family of Rokeby fame, you know, the anti-slavery movement, they were Quakers. There was a Quaker meeting in Vermont in the early part of the 1800s, as there were across several regions. So people tend where there are communities, where there are like-minded people. Catholicism has always intrigued me because in Vermont, it's a 19th century phenomenon. It originates with the Irish in the 1830s and 40s, eventually the French Canadians and the Italians. Each of the churches, there is no single Catholic church. There are nationalistic cultural churches. And in Burlington, it was always, I tend to think of the Jewish joke, this is the one I go to, this is the one I wouldn't go near. But in reality, Catholicism, you know, in Vermont was punctuated. A wonderful story in the 1840s when a group of Irishmen who learned that the first bishop of Vermont is a French-Canadian, de Gosbriant, insist that they're not turning the church over to him, that basically it's their church. So I'm spinning my wheels in a variety of directions, but I think ultimately people come where there are existing communities of like-minded spirit. And I think that very much punctuates both why there is a sort of a secular humanist component, but also a very strong religious component as well.
Yeah, and what's interesting about all of that is if we get back to Noel's comments, when we look at the term unaffiliated, it's not always clear what that means. For some people, they're unaffiliated because they feel not so great about religion for all kinds of good reasons, their own biographies and how they grew up and whatever. And then you have others who would say they're unaffiliated because they don't want to be put in a box, like Noel, but say, gee, you know, all religions have some central messages on their good days that I affirm, that I like, but I don't want to put myself in a box. So getting back to the pew, you have this category, unaffiliated, but unless you unpack it, you don't know what it means. And then your example was great. Catholics who are no longer Catholics, which the Pew study also showed a major decline in Catholicism. In an earlier time, you might interview people who said they were Catholic, but if you actually talked to them, they didn't agree with huge things having to do with the Catholic Church, but they stayed Catholic because they were Italian Catholic or they were Irish Catholic, and they might not speak to each other across that divide. So again, it's a very complex, very interesting story once you start really talking about religion.
We've got Brad on the line from Stowe. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have a question and a comment. My question is, does your panel, do they have any opinions around whether they think that there is a correlation between, as we have an increasingly more centralized and more sophisticated government structure, that would fill the space of what has been the role of religion traditionally, and therefore is the correlation would be then there is a decline in the role of religion in people's lives. And that is my question. My comment is I happen to be somebody who actually read my way into Catholicism.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that, Brad. Why don't we start with you, Jeffrey? What do you think about that, the role of centralized government perhaps playing a role in the decline of religion?
Well, again, I mean, from an historical perspective, from the width of history, what we've witnessed, for instance, in the 19th century, when we think of the great social ferment in Vermont, wonderful book by David Ludlum, you know, he speaks to all the different movements. I mean, it's the movement basically anti-slavery, anti-temperance, any number of different movements. They're facilitated by women. And it's no accident that the women's movement arises out of the fact that churches traditionally empower them because they are traditionally the workers within congregations. In modernity, obviously, with dramatic changes in the workforce, clearly there are significant, there's a significant influence or an impact in terms of when one thinks about the workforce that's available. And the people that are going to basically lead and direct, you know, any number of social movements. I think at the same time, you know, government engagement also ebbs and flows. And I think there's always danger in implying that we're in a singular linear moving in a linear direction.
Well, we have a similar kind of question, Rebecca, that I'd like to put to you from Mark, who writes, there are a large number of nonprofit service groups and organizations that provide much needed services in Vermont for the needy, disabled, elderly, and the vulnerable. In states where there is a much higher preponderance of religiosity, do the churches tend to take the place of these nonprofits that seem somewhat ubiquitous in Vermont?
That's a great question, and one I haven't formally studied, so I have to prognosticate a little bit. And
sure.
Certainly, and we've had a longer conversation last 10 or 15 years about the role of religious organizations that are doing nonprofit helping kinds of work. And I would say that, yeah, and I want to circle all the way back to the point that was made about Mennonite Church and Peace to connect it there, that this Mennonite came and said, wow, there are not a lot of Mennonites here, but here are these peace organizations, so I feel at home in a certain way. So I do think, having not studied it comparatively, I do think just my impression is that, yeah, Vermont has a lot of nonprofit groups that do what you might say are the kinds of work that other religious organizations do. How much a role that plays in sort of distinctions among states, I wouldn't know without looking at it more closely. But the community point here is very important. It's, you know, treading on your territory a little bit. But where do people find community is very key. So for some people, that is the church or the synagogue or wherever, and that's what keeps them tied. And for others, if they find community elsewhere and they are having debates about what's going on in a particular denomination or church or whatever, then that community elsewhere becomes very important to them, and that might be in these kinds of nonprofits or other places.
Could you describe briefly, I understand that you had an experience in Cornwall recently at a church there. What happened there?
Oh, well, I don't know if it's an experience with a capital E, but I was actually sort of not token Jew, but Jew preaching in a Protestant church. I was doing what they call pulpit supply, and the pastor was out of town, and so I stepped in with her. And I had a really interesting conversation with somebody afterward, and it made me think, since I knew I was going to be here today. And she talked about how the church, you know, was very small. It wasn't the number of people there was heavily reduced from what it would have been 100 years ago, for sure, yet very committed, very lively folks. And she was telling me that, you know, some of this just has to do with the change in demographics. All these farming communities had usually a church in town, maybe a couple, often congregational, and that's where everybody went. So it's back to that community issue. Whether or not you had disagreements with some of the doctrinal issues didn't matter so much, because that's where you had your suppers, that's where you had your picnics, that's where you got together and talked about the farm. And so a lot of that still happens, actually, here in Vermont. So for that story, that's a story of decline that almost has more to do with the larger demographics of farming communities not being as full as they used to be, and nearby towns that are more small-C cosmopolitan, like Middlebury next to Cornwall. So there are all these issues that affect it, too.
So many issues. I wish we had time to get to all of them, and I'm afraid that we're out of time here. We've been speaking with Jeffrey Potash, Vermont historian and co-author of the book Freedom and Unity, A History of Vermont, and Rebecca Neal Gould, professor at Middlebury College and scholar of comparative religion. Thank you both so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch. This was great.
And coming up next here on Vermont Edition, look up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a dinosaur. It's both. A new exhibit at the Vermont Institute of Natural Science explores the evolution of dinosaurs into the feathered friends we know today. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. When I was a kid, I went through a pretty typical kid phase, being fascinated with dinosaurs. My room was littered with picture books featuring triceratops, stegosauruses, and of course what we assumed then to be the big daddy of them all, the fearsome T-Rex. But a lot of what we thought we knew about dinosaurs has changed in the years since shows like The Land of the Lost were popular on Saturday morning TV. We knew then that the lizard-like creatures called the Sleestaks, who walked like men on two legs, were not historically accurate. But we also have scoffed at the notion that the common birds flying among us are in fact close living relatives of the dinosaurs that roamed and ruled the Earth tens of millions of years ago. Now a new exhibit at the Vermont Institute of Natural Science called Birds Are Dinosaurs will enthrall a new generation of kids and more than one or two adults as well with the true origins of dinosaurs. Here to tell us more about it is Charlie Radigan, Executive Director of the Vermont Institute of Natural Science, or VINS for short. And Charlie, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
What will people see when they check out this new exhibit?
Well, that's very interesting, Mitch. I think the scientific consensus is that birds are dinosaurs, and not that they are close relatives or descendants, but they are dinosaurs. Essentially, the exhibit is a walk through time. We begin 252 million years ago and end up with the explosion or the Big Bang of modern birds today. So the timeline traverses those millions of years.
And what will the exhibit focus on?
So it has a number of areas to focus on. It's also very much a hands-on type of exhibit, and I'll talk about that in a second. But when you walk in, you actually walk into the Earth as it appears 252 million years ago with the rise of theropod dinosaurs. You mentioned T-Rex in your introduction. That is a theropod dinosaur and actually part of the evolutionary story of birds. It moves from the Triassic to the Jurassic, from the Jurassic to the Cretaceous, and then from the Cretaceous to modern times.
Amazing. Now, part of what seems so surprising about that bird-dinosaur link, and as you're saying, birds really are dinosaurs. First, the feathers. I mean, we tend to associate dinosaurs with having rough, scaly hides, but also the size. How did we get from the enormity of a T-Rex to a little chickadee?
So that's interesting. There are two types of dinosaurs. There are the avian dinosaurs, and of course, then there are the reptilian dinosaurs. So what we know from the fossil record is that the earliest proto-birds, I suppose, had feather-like structures. And most of this has come to our knowledge from paleontologists' work over the last several years, and a lot of it found in China.
So when does this exhibit debut?
So we're opening on Friday. It's very, very exciting. We were inspired by an exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History in New York called Flight in the Age of Dinosaurs. And that was actually a reptile, a pterosaur. And we said, well, we know from the fossil records and from what scientists are telling us that birds are dinosaurs. Let's mount this exhibit and see if we can't launch it in time for this season. And boy, we're doing it.
Well, your timing is great, too. I believe there's another Jurassic Park movie that's coming out. Your exhibit will be much more historically accurate, I'm sure. Charlie Radigan is the executive director at VINS, the Vermont Institute of Natural Science. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, we'd love to see everybody, and you have a specific invitation to come down for a special tour.
I'm going to bring my daughter. She will love it. Thank you, Charlie.
Excellent. Thanks. Bye.
Rutland's Pine Hill Park covers 300 acres of wooded hillside right next to downtown. In recent years, volunteers have created 16 miles of winding trails, a woodsy nirvana for mountain bikers like Shelley Lutz. During the winter, Lutz is an avid backcountry and telemark skier, but once the snow is gone, she switches to backcountry biking. It's a passion Lutz has been sharing with other women in her popular Thursday night mountain bike clinics. As VPR's Nina Keck reports, Lutz's goal is to help women conquer their fears, meet other bikers, and embrace what Lutz calls the joy of trail riding.
It's a balmy May evening, and 18 women gather in the parking lot at Pine Hill Park for the second of five mountain biking lessons.
Now we're going downhill. Where are our pedals? We're coasting.
Level.
Where are our fingers? Okay,
Instructor Shelley Lutz reviews last week's lesson, stressing the finer points of shifting and pedal positions before having the women divide into groups for the evening's trail ride.
All right. Any questions, you guys?
The youngest women in the group are in their 20s. The oldest are 60-something. Some have ridden a lot and come for the camaraderie, while others, like Stacy Elliott of Chittenden, are brand new to the sport.
I got a mountain bike for Christmas, and I wanted to learn how to ride it. And I want to be braver.
What's your biggest fear?
Falling off, for sure. And getting hurt.
Have you?
No, because I don't bike very often, so this I thought would be a great opportunity to learn how to use my bike. And honestly, Pine Hill Park is awesome, and I just want to be able to use this resource that we have in our community.
Lynn Gee, another beginner who lives in Bomazine, admits she took her first spill last week in the parking lot. There'd been a teeter-totter type obstacle set up for the women to ride over, and Gee says that didn't go so well.
I was the only one who fell off my bike last week out of 17 people. There was a diving board that you had to go up the diving board, and then it would tilt and you'd go down. And first time I did okay on it. Second time I sort of dumped off to the side, but it almost happened in slow motion so I could let the bike drop and just roll off onto the grass. But I really don't want to fall tonight. I would just as soon not fall tonight.
Oh, gosh. I don't want to hear that story.
No going over handlebars to these guys.
No. We're the ones who don't need to hear the falling and crashing stories.
This beginner group spent most of their first lesson going over basic techniques in the parking lot. But tonight, they've been promised their first honest-to-goodness trail ride.
Thanks for coming back, you guys. All right? So you guys, like, really nervous now? You're not shaking tonight, so that's a good sign.
Lutz is laughing and joking with the women, but she understands how real their fear is and how important it is to help them overcome it. She says the fact that the group is made up entirely of women is key.
Fear for women is totally different from men. Men tend to be risk takers, thrill seekers. Most of the women we see in the Women's Mountain Bike Clinic, they're not risk takers. The fear factor is extremely high. They're afraid of every little pebble that's in the woods is going to knock them off their bike. And in reality, that's not going to happen, but you have to give them the confidence that it's not going to happen.
I'm like, don't hit the rock.
I know.
I did that too.
The group is breathing hard by the time Lutz stops at an intersection a couple hundred yards up the trail.
So how did everybody like escalators? It's a little bit of a workout, huh? Yeah, all right. So unfortunately, we're still going to be going up, and the tight turn we've got is going to be up here, and I'm going
to
take...
Pointing to where they'll ride next, Lutz describes a hairpin turn they'll take and the rocks she'll help them navigate. Don't look down, she reminds them. Look ahead, and don't forget to shift. Once Lutz gets into position, she calls out for the women to start up the trail.
All right, Stacy, take your time. Grab a hold of that tree and get yourself situated. Here, pedal. Look around your corner. Pedal, 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 pedal. Get your chest down. Woo! Woohoo!
About half the women are able to navigate the turn and stay on their bike. The women who fall off or have to stop have a good laugh and quickly jump back in the saddle.
Outside. Pedal, pedal, pedal. Get your chest down.
My chest is down.
Yeah, there you go.
Woo! Nice job.
I think I dream pedal, pedal, pedal.
Yeah. The camaraderie with the women, it's not so cutthroat, and they're just so much more supportive of one another. And even last week when we were riding, somebody was having a tough time with the teeter-totter, and everybody would stand there, come on, come on, you can do it, you can do it. And it was just the support that women give one another. There's nothing like it. You have to be there to experience it.
Yay, Karen! Yay, Lynn! I only fell down like six times.
I really enjoy doing this with the women because it's a great feeling to see them come out of the woods at the end of a ride with the smiles on their faces. Even if they've fallen over and, you know, scratched up a knee or an elbow, they always get up there smiling and they come out of the woods hooting and hollering and just having a great time for themselves. And I think a lot of these women feel empowered because some of them have never ridden a bike in the woods before.
Besides teaching women, Lutz organizes several popular mountain biking camps for children each summer. She says nothing pleases her more than to see a group of moms drop their kids off, then strap on their own helmets for a ride on the trails. For VPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Rutland.
All right, come on, Christine, pedal, pedal. That's it. Great job, great job.
And that is our program for today. Tomorrow, it was a long, strange winter in Montpelier, and we'll talk with political reporters about the legislative session that just concluded. Taxes, health care, lake cleanup, all issues are on the table for tomorrow's discussion. Tell us what you make of the work that lawmakers did or didn't do. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us for that tomorrow. Now, we did get this comment we couldn't get to before. Chris from Bennington called. He's a Freemason, wanted to make the point that Freemasonry often examines ideas of the human experience and the divine without subscribing to religious dogma. People are free to be Freemasons and also practice other religions, and he says there are Masonic lodges all over Vermont where Freemasons can come together. Chris from Bennington, thank you for that comment on our show on religion today. That is Vermont Edition for today, and Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Devin Karambolis. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Mitch Wertlieb, in for Jane Lindholm, and thank you so much for listening.